Join us for the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society's annual conference. It's happening October 24th through the 26th in New York City. This year's theme, Rethinking Paradigms, Innovative Approaches for Optimal Wellness. And it's not just for healthcare professionals. Teachers, parents, and curious minds are invited too. We've got a phenomenal lineup of keynote speakers. Dr. Thomas Campbell, physician and co-author of The China Study, bringing insights on nutrition and lifestyle medicine. And Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, trauma expert and author of The Body Keeps the Score, who practically rewrote how we think about trauma. I'll be chatting with some of this year's speakers in upcoming episodes of Healthy Brain, Happy Body, so stay tuned to get a sneak peek and maybe even a little inspired. Find the registration link in the show notes. It's 3 days of inspiration, insight, and community you won't want to miss. Here's what Angelica Sadar, executive director of NRBS, is looking forward to.
Anybody that's ever wanted to go to New York City and really like be in the heart of New York City, you should definitely come. If you've never been, you should definitely come. We've got a variety of presenters who are all top leaders in the field. Bessel van der Kolk is coming. Another New York Times bestselling author is coming. Thomas Campbell. The variety and what people are going to bring as far as education is outstanding, and it will be presented in a way that's appealing to parents, educators, and clinicians, and anybody that works clinically, medical folks with patients. It's going to be very relevant.
So join us in New York City, October 24th through the 26th. Find the registration link in the show notes or at nrbs.org. We'll see you there. Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Our guide today is Eric Pepper, well-known authority for biofeedback and self-regulation, and a professor of holistic health studies in the Department of Health Education at San Francisco State University. He is president of the Biofeedback Foundation of Europe and past president of the Association for Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback. Dr. Pepper is the author of numerous articles and books, including Tech Stress, How Technology is Hijacking Our Lives, Strategies for Coping, and Pragmatic Ergonomics, co-authored with Richard Harvey. Dr. Pepper is presenting at this year's NRBS conference on the topic of tech stress, and I talked with him about trying to manage our relationship with the phones, tablets, and other devices that make up our life. Listeners, we are speaking with some of the professionals who are going to be presenting at this year's NRBS conference in New York City. And we have with us today Dr. Eric Pepper. Dr. Pepper, you've been on here before, but so welcome back to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Well, Saul, what pleasure to be present and hopefully to share some information what I'll be talking about at the upcoming conference.
Exactly. And so you'll be giving a talk on optimizing health, particularly in our ever-growing tech-filled world. What are some of the trends or challenges that inspired you to start working on this?
Well, the trend started many years ago, accidentally. You know, if you think of our historical culture, I am a digital immigrant. That means in terms that basically you can look at my hair, you can see it's gray. I started with an IBM Selectric or a regular typewriter. Then I moved to an IBM Selectric. I used my arm to move it. Then I could just press my pinky to move the carriage around. Then all of a sudden, you know, I started to use computers, and that moved into the digital world. Others are basically born already who are digital natives, and they started with computers almost automatically in the world. And in fact, they now show pictures or video clips in humor of someone sitting in front of a computer, and then they do that arm movement where they would normally do a carriage return, and they throw away the monitor. For people who are used to working on typewriters, they would laugh, and people who never saw a typewriter, they don't, what is the person doing? So there's a cultural shift. That's the first one. The second one really is the use, basically moving toward laptops and all this, where it really becomes more a home device. And then cell phones is the next big piece, where all our communications are really via cell phones. So I am also a cell phone immigrant. And we start initially, you know, and now the cell phone carries everything. And the third wave is really where I would say that's social media. And again, once again, I'm an social media immigrant, but some people are literally born with this already. And in fact, they're moving out of social media as we know it, as many of us, where we used to use email. Then, you know, most of my students now don't use email. In fact, there's no way I can contact them with email almost. I need to go to Instagram or I need to do texting or some other media. And so those are real big shifts in communication. What, however, has happened from the other end, the most major trend which facing parents, facing educators, is the now the use of the regenerative AI, and whether that's ChatGPT, Claude, those are the difficult ones, because even as a faculty member, the moment I give someone a homework assignment and they turn it back in, I have no idea if they did it or not. No, there's nothing wrong with using it, you know, and before I make any negative comments, I want to remember a cartoon I use in my presentations often, and that is of the Stone Age. And here, imagine this picture of the Stone Age. You see these two young little kids sitting on a rock, looking at a small fire they had built with the flames and being totally captured by the flames, as many of us do when we go camping or have come camping. No, we just sort of stare off, and you see the father with a big, you know, stick on his shoulder and stuff, and his little, you know, word expression on it, saying, I wonder if this rots their brain. So every generation looks back, most generations look back, and whatever change we do have an effect. The next one, which is coming up, like I said, is regenerative AI. I do think it is slightly different, just like media is, and now let me do that from an evolutionary perspective. And I think that's why it's important. From an evolutionary perspective, until the middle of the 18th century, everything we saw, everything we heard was absolutely real. Because what we saw is what happened to us in front of us, or what we heard was someone telling us. Then with Edison, you know, allowing the telephone to occur, then with media, film, that allowed us now to represent the world in media, and they represent things that may not be real. And the trouble is that from my perspective, we cannot discriminate intrinsically as a biologist, from an evolutionary perspective, we cannot, are not able to really discriminate what's on the screen being real or not real. We always react as if it is real. And I know when I say that, many of you will say, I know I'm watching a movie. It isn't real. However, just start watching a horror movie. For most people who watch a horror movie or somewhere horrible crimes occur, and if they now walk out, go outside, and they hear a crackle outside or footsteps, they react much more with much more fear and terror than if they had watched a very tender, loving scene. And so that means that the movie did make an impact. And now with the oncoming world of regenerative AI, where you can now superimpose people's faces, body movements, and you cannot tell if that person is real or what they're saying, those, I think, are the potential dangers, because it really means that in some sense, the only thing I can trust, you, in fact, as you're listening to it, you have no idea if it's me. And I really mean that. I was shocked because I could just be a digital recording where people have captured my voice enough times. You hear my kind of hidden Dutch accent running through it, my staccato way of speech that gets all copied. And you could be listening to me and it wouldn't have to be me at all. And most likely on a fairly, I would not even say superficial, on a very meaningful level, there's no idea. I did this recently in a different way with my wife, and she was really surprised because I did a blog on pain, which is on pepperperspective.com. And then I took this article as a blog, and then I put it into Google Notebook LM. And then I had it create a podcast out of this between two people talking about this article or blog. It's awe-evoking to me, because when I let other people listen to it, they think these people who are talking are real. You know, it isn't that they have this mechanical voice where it just talks like this how we can think of the electronic voices that we used to see in movies. It is real. It pauses. Are you sure what you're saying? So that is a challenge. And so in a way, we still need to learn how to cope. So let me finish this AI piece for a moment, because there's some new data coming out from studies at MIT where they showed eloquently that if you give college students, you teach them how to write essays, or they have to write essays, basically, and do research papers. And you split them up in two groups. One uses basically Google search to get the information, and the other uses one of the AI large language models, as they're called, to get the information. And you have them do that for 4 or 5 sessions. You know, it's a nice comparative study. And then you look at their EEG while at the last time when they're doing the work. And you measure how much they remember of what they did. The people who had to integrate the material, which is by using, you know, essentially Google search, you pull up information, you have to synthesize it, do it all together. Those people remembered much more than those who use the large language models such as ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude. And if you looked at their EEG, then you see that the EEG for the people who are using, who had to integrate it themselves, the connective pathways were much more active than those who had used the ChatGPT. So in a way, we are decreasing those connectivities. But that may also change because, you know, young kids adapt. We are evolving organisms. And in a young age, we see this as normal and we will cope with it because the brain wants to learn new things. I am concerned for 2 reasons about all this and even about our cell phones. Not because they're always harmful. They're great. I mean, I just went hiking this morning. I didn't know the way. I quickly, you know, put in maps. There was my pathway going through the hills. I knew how to get there. There's a problem with that. Because what I have just done is I've farmed out my memory functions, my storage, my map reading functions, which is part of our initial brain organization, to the computer. If I think of long-term damage, possibly, and that's a hypothesis, then I would think of the future of dementia. What could you think of dementia? Dementia, in many ways, is somehow that the brain starts breaking down, and we know that people who are bilingual or multilingual have less problems. Their brain illnesses are delayed. So if you have a stroke, if you're bilingual, the impact for cognitive function is usually less. And the same thing would be true for people who eventually get Alzheimer's. So as if you have used your brain a lot, you make a lot of neural connections. Now, as whatever the brain damage occurs, those neural connections start peeling away. And that's what you sort of see in dementia, that people start losing the present memory. They start living more and more in the past. Now, what we're doing is we're no longer making those connections. I don't have to use my brain to make maps. I don't have to use my brain to remember numbers. Just ask yourself, what is your partner's telephone number? What is your son's or daughter's telephone number? Many of us don't know, because the only way I know, I go to my cell phone and press. So there's some real questions how we do that. The tools are great. I want to meet friends. I want to get socially connected. They're remarkable. I don't want to ever give those up for that. However, they're the appropriate use. And I think we don't have many biological evolutionary mechanisms right now built into ourselves to set those boundaries. I think that's the protective boundary. That's my concern. So I think teaching should look at that. That is one whole philosophic part. The second part really is that the use of digital devices, as a general rule, means we end up sitting more. That's one. Our ergonomic posture changes. Our breathing pattern changes. We don't take breaks, and we have subtle bracing the whole time. These are all covert physiological changes of which we are unaware, which are high cost. So just ask yourself, when you sit in front of the computer the whole day, how's your vision? Often our eyes get more blurry. Young children, their myopia rates have radically increased. Neck and shoulder discomfort is increasing. You go to college students right now, their spine is slightly more curved, the upper spine slightly more curved forward when they walk in the athletics program. Because how we use ourselves changes the structure. And that's the other. So part of the talk will be, what are some strategies you can do to become aware of these physiological and cognitive changes and what you can do about it?
So what are some strategies that one can do? If you don't mind giving a few up entice more people to come to the conference.
I would say, on the one hand, good luck. Because we all know, just like any New Year's wish, I'm going to exercise more. I'm going to eat less or eat more. You know, we do that great for 2 weeks, then we stop or easily fall off the wagon. So it's challenging. But there are a couple of really useful ones. One, I think, is just to become aware. And most people are aware. So, you know, if you are sitting at the desk, for example, right now, if you're listening, although probably you may be driving instead or something like that, but if you are sitting on a desk, then you need to put your hand next to your keyboard. And now imagine you're holding a mouse. And now I'm going to ask you to draw the letters of your last name backwards and, you know, lift the mouse. And between each letter, do a click. And then I like you to do it as rapidly as possible and make each of the letters only about a half inch high or a quarter inch high. As you do that, if you did that right now, so you start, like in my name, it's Pepper, I would draw the R. And I almost don't do any movement because the movement is very small, but you need to do it quickly. Then I click, then I go to the E. And what you would observe, you held your breath, you tightened your shoulders. You may have tightened your stomach a bit. You may have gone a little more forward, totally unaware till you do it. And those we do automatically, continuously. And imagine you do this the whole day long. So the question is, how can you become aware? You can use apps on your computer to remind you to interrupt yourself. You can use devices such as you put in your spine, which are, you know, which look at your posture. And every time you slouch, which is, I think, is one of the best devices I know, every time I slouch, it vibrates, it reminds me, and I sit up. You don't have to sit up per se, you just wiggle and move. So there are many of these strategies. And then we forget breathing, which is critical, that our breathing pattern changes the moment you slouch. I was just working with a client yesterday, no, not yesterday, Friday, and a very lovely young person. And, you know, he's really good. And all we did, he was doing slow heart rate variability training, although on the screen we looked both at the breathing pattern and the heart rate, because most people don't do that anymore. They just only look at the device. You lose all the subtlety of individual beat-by-beat differences. And so we did two things. I had him sit up more, you know, and he learned to be that way. And he had breathing. It was very easy because now his stomach could expand more. He had very good heart rate variability. And then I just had him go into his normal cell phone slouch look. And the moment he did that, you could just see the heart rate variability decrease. It was very dramatic for him. And then, you know, looking again at heart rate variability for a moment, we were training him to really warm his hands and feet as well. Because really, when you do this slower diaphragmatic breathing, often the hands warm up. And then you could see this heart rate variability, each of the waves doing very well. And then you saw one wave where it was going down, but it didn't quite go down again. It stayed up, and then it went up again. So it's like it didn't quite go to the down part. But I would say if I'd looked at the statistical average, you would probably never have seen it. So then I asked him what happened. At that moment, he was trying to push the air down his arm metaphorically. So he shifted from allowing to trying. That's what makes biofeedback magical. It is those individual momentary pictures, because we're totally unaware of these subtle changes. And I still don't know any easier tools than whether it's using heart rate, muscle tension, etc. So the final one, I think, what can you do? There are infinite number of things you can do. But the easy one, I think, for anyone just listening, it's probably your eyes. The moment you work for a while, stop. Because when I'm looking at the screen, I am focusing on the screen. That means my eyes converge. They are under visual tension. You have no idea you're doing that. But that is tension. And then for a moment, look outside, look at the green, look at the far distance. And if you do that, the eyes diverge and can regenerate. And now you look at young children, especially those during COVID, but the pattern started way before. COVID didn't change anything. It just amplified what was going. Do you see the increase in myopia, nearsightedness? Because the eyes for young kids are continually developing and function changes the structure. And we now know that if you collapse more, you probably have an increase in anxiety and depression if you shift your posture. So those are some of the themes I probably touch upon.
So these are all strategies and approaches for some of the tech stress that you've been talking about for a long time now. So whether it's overuse of, I guess, initially computers, then shifting to phones and tablets, and even with social media, it's interesting. We're sort of going from machine to abstract ideas. And then in AI, it's almost an integration of ideas and machines. And it's, you know, we started out the conversation with you kind of laying out some potential concerns about memory, and it'll be really interesting to observe it, perhaps less interesting to be part of it, which I suppose we can't entirely escape.
Well, you know, speaking of that, I do think, you know, we have a sort of in the culture right now, because the age group is getting up, there's more awareness of Alzheimer's as a major disorder and dementia. I'm totally persuaded, although you have the APO gene or whatever it's called, right? That is a genetic predisposition. If you have both of them, you could get early onset Alzheimer's. However, just because you have that gene, it doesn't mean you'll get it. And I think that's what people, so the way I now always think about it, genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. And so far I can understand Alzheimer's, looking outside the box, and partly because we're finishing a new book, that there are a lot of suggestive studies or there's a lot of evidence that lifestyle is a major contributor to the onset of Alzheimer's. So that can be all the toxins we are exposed to. That's one. It's clearly we live in a world of, I would say, of massive, almost diabetes, but really glycemic. We eat totally highly glycemic, and the brain is highly sensitive to react to high glycemic episodes. And in rat studies, you can induce Alzheimer-like plaques by just feeding them sugar in about 2 months or so. And almost all the protocols where you look at the brain, if you give the brain less glucose, as we know it, the brain does better. You know, and so those are the models in epilepsy, where you see that carbohydrate diets for people with epilepsy is disastrous from my perspective. Or you can treat most epilepsy in young children by changing the diet and make the diet totally ketogenic, a keto diet. That doesn't mean you own, it used to be a keto diet is only meats, butter, and fats, or whatever, meats, basically, very simplistically. In fact, you can have a totally vegetarian keto diet, but you really don't want to have many simple digestible carbohydrates. And if you take those away, and what people have found with young children with epilepsy, that almost probably 90% of epilepsy can be in kids controlled by total diet change, hard to believe, and interacting that with breathing. And some of these kids, when they go on this kind of diet, good luck, and I really mean as a parent, because, you know, they go to school, here's a candy, and the data is overwhelming with some of these kids. You give them a half muffin, and they'll trigger a seizure. And so they're unbelievably reactive to that. And I think our brain and our bodies, from an evolutionary perspective, are more reactive and defends itself against these glucose changes or insulin changes, whatever it may be, the mechanisms. And this goes right back to the 1920s when the Nobel Prize was given for cancer, that cancer was a metabolic disease of the mitochondria, the inability to process glucose. And so it's interesting, you know, so I do think that we live in a world, and maybe we should not just look only at digital devices. Health for young children, for adults and young children, we are a system. And that means what is lacking now for many kids in schools, especially if you're in big cities, is automatic movement and exercise. You know, from my bias, many young boys should not be sitting 6 hours in school on a chair. They should be running around and being crazy because they need to develop those fine motor skills, and it takes a while, and then slowly move. Many people no longer play the childhood games that they used on the street, because we think the streets are so much more dangerous. They're no more dangerous than they were 50 years ago. No more kids are abused. No more kids are sexually molested than 50, percentage wise. But now, however, the media brings it up, and our brain is still wired, from my perspective, like we lived in a clan of 200 or 300 people. And so when that graphic single case goes up, it isn't one in 250 million people or whatever. We think it's in our neighborhood, even though the neighborhood could be Chicago or Oakland or wherever you are. It's unbelievably hard to do that. And so we have taken a model of safetyism, which is really not my term at all, but I like the term, and our diet changes are major changes. So that's just two parts of many.
So we need, as you're saying, we need to look at the whole system. It's much more nuanced than we might think. And I think it's hard to do nuance.
And that is the error, I would say, of psychology as a general rule, and the error especially of medicine, because much of our research is not based upon individual difference. Almost all research studies published deal with averages. And every study, it makes a difference whether it's surgery, whether it's drugs, whether it's psychotherapy. You take a certain protocol, and then you look at the average benefit. If it's a certain benefit, then you apply it. Then you say it works. But in every one, regardless which one, they're going to be, for some people, it's going to be superbly beneficial. And for some people, it doesn't work at all or it's bad. And we don't ever, I'm not saying we don't ever, usually the decision is not, we don't know those details of those outliers. And often in research, you throw out those outliers. Versus they are the ones that hold the information. Those are the clients we see. So many times the mean, the average, doesn't really apply to you. It also reminds me of the airplane seat. An airplane seat is designed for the average human being. But if you're 6'2", forget it. No airplane seat works for you. Or if you're 6'4". And if you're 4'8", they also don't work for you because they're too deep. And so that's what we forget. And so much of, and then that's one error. And the second error is that research, all the reinforcers in research tend to be to identify a single causal factor. And in fact, in many cases, life is much more complex. You know, it's like there are multiple factors which add together. One may be more critical than another, but it's like we need to look at the complexity of it. And that research funding doesn't go easily that way because it's usually not easily patentable. I'm sorry, I'm being cynical.
No, I'm laughing because I think so many of the folks I talk to on the show, we can so easily go to start critiquing the medicine and science, and maybe let's not, the systems of medicine. Correct. And science. And it reminds me, you're talking of Uri Bronfenbrenner, a developmental theorist who talks about multiple environments that we live in, and that he said the main effect is in the interaction. We need to look at the complexity.
Yes.
And on the one hand, I think that that's actually quite overwhelming because of the complexity. On the other hand, I think it's quite hopeful because it allows for a lot of creativity and really going, particularly the work that we do, we are working with the person in front of us, not with the average.
Yes.
And so we can really work with that person and figure out what works for them.
Well, let me give an example of the complexity in a very simple way. You know, when you think of maybe even ADHD-like behavior, the EEG, okay, or people have problems like this, or more anxiety or panic attacks, That works out. There is an interaction between breathing and blood sugar levels. You know, so if I only taught you to breathe, that's very nice. And I happen to really propose that breathing is one of the critical pieces that is a major factor in us. However, if your blood sugar is low, you're going to be much more reactive. And if you have very low blood sugar and you start hyperventilating a little bit, you really become reactive. On the other hand, if blood sugar is quite high, and I'm not recommending keeping a high blood sugar level, but normal, then you won't be as reactive. And every parent almost knows this phenomenon. You know, when your child comes home from school at 4 o'clock or so, and before dinner time, they're just totally often more difficult. You know, they're hangry, which is the classical term. What is hangry really? If they're slightly hunger, that means their blood sugar level is low, possibly because of the rebound, because they ate these nice, lovely sweets during lunch from our government-supplied food sources. And I'm being very cynical about that because I think it's horrible. And then you get irritated, you start breathing more, then the EEG drops in frequency. And then if you had epilepsy, you could trigger a seizure, but otherwise you just are a difficult child who has impulse control problems. I'm being simplistic.
It's hard to talk about these things in anything but a simplistic fashion, because then it would take hours to talk about that 1 30-second example. But to bring it, to wrapping it up, and I'm going to ask you to oversimplify. For listeners or for people who are coming to your talk, and it's going to be a mixture of clinicians and educators and parents, what is one or two simple things that we might do?
I think the three major things I would say is, one, account for sitting disease. That means get up every few minutes, every half an hour. So at the end of this talk, even now, as you're listening, get up and stretch and then sit down again. Very simple. Do something. Use a lot. That's one. Two, posture is much more important than people think. Our body posture. We used to think that, you know, consciousness just resides in the brain and emotions reside, are linked, and the message go from the top down. 80% of our vagus information goes upward, in fact. And so our body posture, how we use our body, and maybe even our GI tract, changes our moods and emotions. So therefore, becoming aware of your body, your posture, and I'll go through that, I'll guide some exercises by being more upright, you'll see a significant change. Three, learn to observe your breathing pattern. It is critical. Are you holding your breath? Are you shallow breathing, etc.? That will affect you. And four, there are some pragmatic tools that you can do using with these digital devices. There's no easy magic, because if you're a parent and you have young children, let's be honest, we are wired to react to stimuli. There's nothing better than visual stimuli than what comes on a screen or anything else. And if you have any doubt about that, just remember when you start watching the movies of the 1940s. God, are they slow. But basically, our brain, that tells you how our brain has changed, even us. But we are captured by those stimuli. And so it's very hard to say to a child, don't watch it. Because they're wired for evolutionary survival to react to stimuli outside. That could be a saber-toothed tiger or something, or food. So develop social networks with other parents where they all agree maybe that children for a certain time period should not use cell phones, should not be on screens. If you just do it by yourself, it's almost impossible, because the child will go next door and they spend all their time playing the computer games. So we really talk about social network.
Well, Eric, thank you again for joining us. Looking forward to your talk in October.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's so much glad to see you, Saul.
You are listening to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Our guide today was Eric Pepper, expert on biofeedback, neurofeedback, holistic health, and tech stress. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us to get more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. This year, we'll be gathering in New York City, October 24th to the 26th. Be sure to join us. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.